Hi, this is Tony Asher, President of the ANS. At our meeting this year in Chicago, we're going to be focusing on what matters. That to me in the scientific sessions means that we're going to be placing emphasis on what truly matters to your practice and your ability to understand the trajectory of our specialty in 2024. Specifically, in all of our subspecialty areas, we will have summaries of everything that's important to practice today and in the next several years, so that you can go out and practice in ways that are both relevant and important to the patients that we serve. It's very important to us that you understand that you will also have the opportunity to perhaps get a little bit more granular about your subspecialty interest in our afternoon sessions. But expect during the plenaries for there to be a very concentrated focus on a comprehensive overview of all subspecialty areas in neurosurgery.
This is the Neurosurgery Podcast.
Welcome back to the Neurosurgery Podcast. Here we are together again in person, another episode recorded here in fabulous Las Vegas at this year's Spine Summit, and again joined by someone who needs no introduction, of course, because of how many times he's been on the show. I kid. It's Dr. Rick Fessler back again for his fourth appearance on the podcast. I'll point our listeners back to some of his previous appearances, the first of which was recorded in our very first season of this show when we kicked things off, talking about a topic relevant for today's conversation, minimally invasive spine surgery. In that first conversation, we kind of talked about why MIS is good, why it works, why you've adopted it and really spearheaded its promulgation throughout spine surgery. But today I thought we could take a look back on the history of that process, the development, popularization, and widespread adoption of MIS techniques in spine. But Dr. Fessler, in case any of our young listeners don't know who you are or haven't heard your previous episodes, if they're new to the show, please take a moment to say hello to the audience.
Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be back again with John Paul and with Mike Wang to talk about this. As I was walking up here today, thinking about, well, how did minimally invasive spine surgery actually get started? I recall an episode that really initiated this, I think. I was actually in Utah at a meeting where we were creating guidelines for doing endoscopic surgery, like transforaminal endoscopy. And I'm sitting there, and this was done. The group was called SAGES. It's a general surgery group that did all of their guidelines for abdominal surgery. And so I was learning from them how you create these guidelines. And one of the guys was sitting there and talking about this, and he said, well, yeah, I just had my gallbladder taken out yesterday in New York, for example, and now we're in Utah. And I'm looking at him thinking, oh my God, if they could do that minimally invasively, you know, our results in spine aren't so good. We've got to be able to do surgery minimally invasively. And that's where the original idea came from.
Yeah, so maybe to set the stage for this history that we're going to walk through, it's, you know, this question could itself be a whole conversation. And I talked about it with Dr. Luis Tumilan on a previous episode. But maybe from your perspective, from the horse's mouth, so to speak, could you define minimally invasive spine surgery for us?
Sure. Minimally invasive spine surgery has nothing to do with an incision. It's all about what happens to soft tissue. So minimally invasive surgery is a surgical technique designed to minimize soft tissue damage for any operation you do, all the way from a discectomy to scoliosis.
So, Rick, first of all, thank you for coming back on the show, and congratulations to you and your son. Your son's graduating residency this summer, right?
He is, in 3 months.
Big accomplishment to have a son follow in your footsteps like that. It's the greatest honor and greatest demonstration of your contribution, not only to society, but your family. Do me a favor, and some of our audience, they don't know the history well, right? We'd like to hear from you sort of in an encapsulated form, the evolution of these different techniques that we now have today. Like how exactly did that play out? What were the key principal technical or educational hurdles that were overcome in this process?
Well, it's interesting. So the first minimally invasive operation we did was a tubular discectomy. And actually the first person ever to do that was Bill Friedman. He was working through a chest tube and doing a discectomy. That was, wow. And he published that in Neurosurgery in the 80s. Yeah. And then Wolf blocking on his last name. Kaspar.
Not was Blitzer? Actually,
yeah, Kaspar was the second person to do it. And then Mo Smith and Kevin Foley developed the Metrix tube, probably in the early 90s. And we were just doing discectomies and foraminotomies with them. And the results were so good that I said, you know, we've got to be able to do more. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of late nights in the cadaver lab. In fact, one of my fellows says his psychiatrist still says he hasn't recovered from that. And we started doing other operations. The first one was probably cervical foraminotomies, and then lumbar stenosis, and then intradural tumors. And then at the same time as we were doing those minimally invasive procedures, we were developing percutaneous instrumentation to go along with it. And then ultimately, in around 2000, we started doing minimally invasive scoliosis, which has been transformational for the patients.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, hearing you talk about those old days and how much time you spent in the cadaver lab, do you recall the first real surgery in a live patient that you did through a tube and what that experience was like?
It was hard.
Yeah.
It was hard. Well, partially it was hard because the camera technology we had in those days was not very good. The original camera had a plastic lens, and it was really a blurogram. You couldn't tell the difference between muscle tissue, fascia, or dura. And it was really taking a leap of faith when you did your operations. I do distinctly remember the first minimally invasive TLIF I did, which was through an 18-millimeter tube, the Metrix tube. It took me 8 hours.
Wow.
So we're in Vegas, and I like to tell our trainees that one of the great triumphs of MIS was here with the Williams sequestrectomy procedure, right, on Showgirls, right? That's so, yep. So the paper goes. And so we did see that revolution take off. That is, instead of just making a 6-inch incision, pulling up and down with the coker on the sacrum, and then not getting an x-ray and figuring out what level you're at, right?
Right, yeah.
And so that all changed, of course. Then people did microdiscectomies. But today, we don't necessarily see MIS surgery as sort of like a standard, right? In other words, you're a pioneer. I certainly drink the Kool-Aid. But why is it? Like, if MIS surgery is really that much better, why isn't it just the standard? Why isn't it that this is a requirement that everybody do this because it's better for the patient?
Yeah. Part of it is generational. An older surgeon knows how to do his surgery one way, and he gets good results, and why should he change? Younger surgeons are going to adopt it, and then it depends upon which institutions have minimally invasive surgeons to teach them. If all they're learning is open surgery, that they're probably going to do open surgery. So we haven't had a big enough influx of minimally invasive spine surgeons in academic, in every academic program, to really change it so that every surgeon coming out knows how to do minimally invasive surgery.
Yeah, you know, when you were just talking about that blurogram, that strikes me as someone who's coming up now in an age of widely available MIS, and obviously I train with you at Rush, so the vast majority of spine surgery that we do is MIS, so I'm seeing it from day one. To me, it is normal. You know, the fish doesn't know what water is. It's what I'm swimming in. But it seems like this principle that you defined about minimizing soft tissue damage, that's the definition of MIS conceptually. But from a technical standpoint, it's a question of access and visualization, right?
Right.
And so you had those blurograms. The access, obviously, is typically tubular surgery is what we're talking about, though, again, it's more about the soft tissue preservation. But what was visualization like from the early days, starting with that blurogram? And, you know, we talked about the different procedures you were doing, but along that same time course, what were the technological evolutions in your visualization?
The next camera for the Metrix system was a glass lens camera. Mm. That tremendously improved our vision. And that's the way that particular system stayed throughout. There weren't many more improvements. One of the next things that really improved was splitting the tube so that we actually had a small soft tissue opening on the top, on the fascia, but a much larger one on the bottom. So then we could start doing laminotomies, opening the dura and going after tumors and stuff like that. So that increased not only visualization through the camera, but also spatially. We had better anatomy.
Yeah, it's really all about visualization, right? Because if you can't see, you can't operate, right?
Right.
And Rick, I've been honored to be able to work with you on the Telligen project for, oh my God, it's been a decade now, over a decade.
It's been over a decade, yeah.
And, you know, I've learned so much from you and the other folks on the team, and I've been using the system. I think it's really changed a lot of the patient experience. Tell our audience a little bit about how the process came about, because sometimes people see the end result and they don't really understand why a thing is built the way it's built, right?
So, you know, literally more than 10 years ago, six surgeons got together with the development crew at DePue and sat down in a conference room for 3 days to exchange ideas on what a new endoscopic, minimally invasive system would look like. What were the key things that it really had to have? And then over the course of another year, we refined those down into something that could be produced and be marketable and started working on that. And, you know, the key features that came out with it was we wanted the tube to be small. So we ultimately settled on 15 millimeters. We wanted better camera technology than we had. We wanted a system that would wash itself and dry itself so we didn't have to take the camera out. Mm. And we wanted an excellent video screen. And those are the four really novel things about the Telligen system.
Yeah, I mean, and of course I have a conflict on this, right? So it's, you know, I found it to be very useful. I mean, I think that if I look at the patients who've had this procedure, they almost do better than the endoscopic fusion, even though that's a smaller portal. But because I can get a good decompression of the nerve root and see the dura and do all of that, I mean, they all universally could go home the same day, if not, and I keep them overnight, but they all go home the next day. That doesn't happen with endoscopic surgery necessarily. There's something about actually getting the job really well done, but that size is, I mean, I don't know what you think the ideal size is. I feel like getting under 18 was really critical, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think for skilled surgeons, the smaller tube is fine. I think many surgeons are not going to be able to operate in that small of a tube. And so I think it might be a good idea to have a second tube size, for example, 21 millimeters, maybe something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that will bring in a lot more surgeons to do it endoscopically.
What do you think is the critical size? Because I think the standard T-lift tube that people are using for MIS is something like 26 right now. It's pretty big, right?
It's probably, I know of a 24 anyway. I don't know about 26, but there's a 24.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I do. When I'm teaching my residents to do a T-lift, for example, and I'm not doing it, for example, with Telligen, I would use a 24 millimeter tube.
Okay.
If I'm doing it myself,
right,
I'll use a 18 or something like that. But the residents need a little bit more space to maneuver.
And we appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Training wheel tube, yeah. Right? That is really fascinating. And I will also say for any younger listeners, even early in residency, but it was a subtle point, but the fact that the Telligen system can clean and dry itself without taking the camera in and out, that sounds to perhaps the uninitiated, and I'm barely initiated, but that might sound like a trivial thing. But that's going to remove literally minutes from a case over the course of the case. Then you add that up over the course of several patients. And any time, not just the time to do it, but any time you remove taking something in and out of the body while you're operating, I think that's a good thing. But
not only does it make the case go faster, but by not removing a camera in and out and in and out, you're going to reduce your infection rate.
Right, exactly. And I what I'd like to talk about now is something that many people may not think about on a deep level, but the optics and visualization of surgery from a technological standpoint. So most anyone in neurosurgery is used to operating with eyes, with loops, with a microscope. Depending on where you are, we really don't get much exposure to an endoscope in the setting of spine. I think any neurosurgery program is going to see it for transsphenoidals, for cranial neurosurgery, and some places even more than just transsphenoidals, ventricular surgery, for example. But the use of the endoscope in spine is certainly not as widespread in the United States, where most of our listeners are. So maybe talk a bit about why, and if we really want to nerd out about the physics, the how that direct and short distance visualization is so superior to the focal distance of loops or even a microscope being that far away from what you're actually looking at.
Well, there's a couple advantages to that. And that's what we forgot to mention that about Telligen. One of the advantages of Telligen is that the tube is customizable. So that if you've got a skinny patient, you can cut it down and only have to work through 3 centimeters. If you've got a fat patient, maybe you'll be working through 9, but you can cut it to whatever length is going to be perfect for that patient. And that'll make your procedure easier.
Yeah.
Now you can also focus the camera for this system has a large focal distance, so that you can pull the camera up to the tip of the tube. You can push it all the way down to the bottom, for example, when you're going to be working underneath the dura, so that you can really see a magnified version of your operative field. Visualization is key.
Yeah, and on top of that, because the camera is at the working end of the tube, this whole idea of like when you use a microscope, you got to get a light down to the body of the tube.
Keep your hands out of the view. Keep your hands out of the view.
Yeah, so everything's always out of your way, and then the ability to use the camera at different positions on the clock, and to digitally adjust for that. Like in endoscopic surgery, the fellows always get very confused when you turn the endoscope and suddenly north is now cranial instead of medial.
Yeah.
And you have to do a lot of mental math. And you can get good at that, but it is very disorienting for people.
Yeah. And that this ought to, you know, all you do is touch the screen and it adjusts for you.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that additional pathologies besides basic lumbar degenerative stuff is going to be handled with this, or you think this is really where it's going to be at, this type of procedure?
I think the system as it's designed right now is going to be good for discs, stenosis, and T-lifts, and cervical foraminotomies and discectomies. Right now the fusion system is really too expensive to do the smaller operations, but in 6 months we're going to have a coned down version to do those other operations as well. I don't think with the current system we're going to be doing intradural tumors, because usually the tumor is bigger than the tube. But I think if we have a slightly bigger tube, that might be possible.
Well, now you train a lot of folks, fellows, residents. You know, what has been your experience? And I'd like to get JP's take on this as well. Like, what has been your experience? You know, Joshua Woodward is one of our fellows. He trained in Rush, and he's very good at this. Like, what do you think the learning curve is like with this?
I would say for a routine case, stenosis or a disc, 25 cases, and then you're going to be quite comfortable at it.
You know, it is interesting, because just today I went to a few different talks about novel technologies, and the learning curve is always quoted a number of cases, and I, perhaps because of how juvenile I am, I've never really thought back on my own progress in terms of number of cases. I think in terms of what was I doing that PGY, and what did I feel comfortable doing that PGY? That's still my unit of time, but that sounds about like my experience. I honestly, at Rush, we get so much more tubular spine surgery and minimally invasive spine surgery that I was exposed to that and did so many of those cases before doing things open, and I was lost. I mean, I even just trying to control the drill at that length down a tube, I distinctly remember the day I changed the way my hand was gripping the drill, and suddenly I could control that thing like normally, and that was an epiphany moment for me. But now, having done some open surgery and just having done more MIS cases, it is striking how you can develop that sense of where you are and what's surrounding what you can just see in the tube. I haven't used the Telligen yet, unfortunately, but I'm looking forward to it. But I really look forward to having the technical challenge of tubular access with that superior visualization.
Yeah. One of the things I found that really helps your learning curve is if, for example, you can do 3 T-lifts in 1 week.
Yeah.
If you do one on week one and you do one 6 weeks later, you don't learn as much from that as if you can do one right in a row. I mean, that way you really start getting it.
Yeah, I often, all the junior residents, when they're trying to figure out what room would be good to be in, anything that has more than one of the same case in one room on one day, that go to that room. That's the best.
And the other thing, one of the other tricks to learn about minimally invasive surgery through a tube is that you're working through a very small area, and we are used to triangulating our instruments.
Yeah.
And in a tube, you can't. You have to work in parallel. And when sometimes you're trying to do something and you're finding your instrument just can't get there. And what's happening is you're arguing with your instruments. They're across each mm-hmm. other, and you have to get them back parallel so that you can do the job.
How do you prepare people for these surgeries? Do you put them in a cadaver lab? Do you have them watch you do it? Do you work with them? And like, how do you teach folks? You've taught so many fellows that become leaders in MIS spine.
Yeah, we try and do cadaver labs when we can, but mostly they're learning it by doing it, by you know being there. And you know the way I'm doing it, if I don't work with junior residents very much anymore, but when I am, I will do the case and they will watch, and I'll bring them in for parts that they can do, and then start bringing them along so that by the time they're a fifth year, they're doing the whole procedure. And after you've been teaching for a long time, you can see when someone is struggling. You know, when they're not making progress, when their bite is tentative, they're not quite sure where they are. So,
hey boss, I'm right here. well, I wonder, because I do still want to tap more of the history and how we got to today, and you know, not just the 10 years of developing this specific device, but everything that went into it, the 10 years before that allowed you to develop it. If you could think back to that first minimally invasive TLIF that you did, as you were grueling away for the 8 hours taking, I don't even want to think how many x-rays, because I know how many I take.
And I can tell you how many swear words, too.
Right. What would you tell yourself that day, looking back now, in terms of, now that you know where you got with not just the technology, but the technique, what would you tell yourself that day about where you were going to take that field?
Well, I probably walked out and said, I'm never going to do that again. So, in retrospect, I must have been pretty dedicated to actually try a second one.
Yeah.
I think, for those of you who are listening who do not know Rick Fesser, you're probably new to neurosurgery, but I think, Rick, you've done so much in this field to push the envelope, and I hope you continue to do that. I think that it's a fantastic contribution. I don't have the patience you have and tolerance to do the kind of teaching, but I've heard about this from so many of your fellows many of whom are senior to me, that you have a special methodology for bringing young men and women along this track. It's very special. I hope somebody takes over that mantle. And the days that, you know, when you decide you stop operating, who is that person? I was hoping it was going to be your son, right?
I think it's going to be you, isn't it?
I mean, I don't have your temperament. Your temperament is exceptional. I don't know if it's because of your upbringing or your the way your psychological makeup is, but you have a special kind of temperance. I wish that more people had that.
Well, I hope that other people do. I mean, I have many fellows now. Even though you're not my official fellow, as you know, you're my adopted fellow, and even more residents. And I can say that there is nothing in my career I am more proud of than my fellows and my residents.
Well, as your current resident, I appreciate that greatly. The things that I've learned from you cannot be quantified, but the one thing I always do remind everyone that I now get to teach how to do things is that the first lateral masseter I ever placed, I was standing across the table from you. You said, this is how I do it, and did one. And you said, now do that. And I did it exactly as you did. And that's the way I've done it every single time for the past 5 years. And that's the way I show everybody how to do it.
That's why they're all in the foramen.
Well, for listeners interested in the Ultra MIS type of spinal surgery for decompression or fusion, I would recommend they take a look at Johnson & Johnson's DePuy Synthesis Intelligent System. It's really exciting. Congratulations, Rick. It's been a fantastic time working with you on this.
Well, congratulations to you, Mike. We worked together for this on a long time.
Disclaimer time. The opinions and ideas expressed in this show are solely those of myself, Dr. Wang, and our guests. They do not represent the opinions of any professional institution or organization. This show is for entertainment purposes only and does not constitute the giving of medical or legal advice. Listening to or participating in this show does not constitute continuing medical education or any other professional certification. It's just a show, everybody.